you. Reading from the Holy Gospel according to St. Matthew. As Jesus got into a boat, his disciples followed him. Suddenly a violent storm came up on the sea, so that the boat was being swamped by waves, but he was asleep. They came and woke him, saying, "Lord, save us, we are perishing." He said to them, "Why are you terrified, O you of little faith?" Then Jesus got up, rebuked the winds and the sea, and there was great calm. The men were amazed and said, "What sort of man is this, whom even the winds and the seas obey?" The Gospel of the Lord. Today's reading of the book of Genesis about the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, we see God's great will to save. It's not the first thing we might think of when we think of the scene, but we see out of love for Abraham what the Lord was willing to do for Lot, who minimally was hopelessly naive with what was happening in Sodom and Gomorrah. But he sent his angel, saying, "Get up on your way, take with you your wife and your two daughters, or you'll be swept away in the punishment." Lot hesitated. So the angel seized his hands and the hands of his wife and two daughters and led them to safety outside of the city, telling them, "Flee for your life, don't look back or stop anywhere." They wanted to separate them, not only from the destruction, but what was causing the destruction. So great was their will to save. God's will is always that way. A few days after the Supreme Court's decision, making the legal pretension that marriage can be a husbandless or a wifeless institution in the U.S., after they said that the basis of their interpretation of law will be personal autonomy, where there is no common law, it's just everybody's self-law, it's important for us to grasp God's continual will to save. He wants to save us from a fallen culture. He wants to save us from the conflagration of corrupt love, which we call lust, that will destroy individuals, that will destroy homes, that will destroy communities, nations, civilizations, etc. It tells us to flee from it, to turn our back on these sins, and not to look back, not to have any affection. You know, this scene of the destruction of Lot's wife into a pillar of salt has been depicted in art over the course of the centuries, but it was a Hebrew idiom that she died. She turned back, life was taken out of her, and essentially she was on the path to just becoming salt again after the total decomposition of the human person. But to not look back with affection, to not hanker for these types of things, to recognize that even if you want to say that the sin of Sodom and Gomorrah was fundamentally about inhospitality, as some try to argue, it was a particular type of inhospitality. It was a lustful molestation, which was the inhospitality there. And we have to grasp that there are cultural forces that are trying to suck people into this type of culture. So God, with His incredible will to save, tells us, get up on your way. Take your family members with you, lest you be swept away in the punishment. Don't look back. Don't stop anywhere on the plain. Hike that hill. Don't be afraid of the exertion. That's what God will tell us. He'll tell us to take the members of the family. He'll tell us, like Abraham, whom we would have heard yesterday, it wasn't the solemnity of Saints Peter and Paul, that we're praying that God will save on account of the 50 or the 40 or the 30 or the 20 or the 10. Or even the one, his son. today in the gospel, we see that will to savor the Lord and how some of the times it's a challenge for us. All of Jesus' life can be summarized by this will to save. God sent His Son not to condemn the world, not that the world might perish, but so that the world might be saved through Him. But on occasion, it seems that God isn't continuing that saving pattern. It seems like He's asleep when we're crying out. Hey, haven't we been praying in this fortnight for freedom? And then, bang, in the middle of the fortnight for freedom, God gives us this Obergefell decision. Seems like He's asleep. It seems like He's not paying attention. St. Mark's version of the scene, which gives us a couple extra details from the mouth of St. Peter. They say to Jesus, "Do you not care that we are perishing?" As if the Lord's will would be that He wouldn't love us continuously. As if the reason why He was asleep, the reason why He didn't seem to be responding, was because He didn't give a hoot. No, Jesus challenges our faith in these times. The reason why God occasionally doesn't respond immediately is so that we can grow in persevering faith. If every time we asked, He immediately responded, we might take it for granted. But our faith will expand the more persevering we are. So this is a time of persevering prayer. The prayers of the fortnight have not been wasted. Prayers of the fortnight are supposed to make us like that importune woman, banging on the door continuously until the Lord lets us become instruments in His saving will. We might be in for some rough seas. The storms will be buffeting against the boat. We might get really wet. But we know that the Lord is with us in the bark of Peter. And so it's a time for us to grow in greater faith as we act on that faith at a time when it's hard. Today we mark the feast of the first martyrs of the Church of Rome. Yesterday we celebrated St. Peter and St. Paul. St. Peter would have died in October 1364 AD with the Christians we celebrate today. St. Paul probably a little while longer. The reason why we celebrate their feast on the same day, it was because on the third of the calends of the month of Iuli in the year 258, they began to live together in the catacombs of St. Sebastian, we now call St. Sebastian. Their relics were taken there in the persecution of the Emperor Valerian so that they wouldn't be confiscated by the Roman authorities after the lapsed Christians confessed why the Christians were going so frequently on the road to Ostia where Paul's tomb was, or on the Vatican Hill where Peter's tomb was. But there's no real evidence that they were ever killed on the actual day. Peter was killed as a result of the fire in Rome, as the Christians were made scapegoats for what Nero had done. St. Paul, as a Roman citizen, would have been executed later. But today we mark these ordinary Christian men and women who were caught in the midst of the storm, who were caught in the midst of the debauchery of the Roman Empire, who were caught as scapegoats after Nero had set a fire July 1964 that destroyed 10 of the 14 sections of the city of Rome, including most of the inhabitable sections. Nero was in a lot of trouble, and he needed to find a way to escape it. And he had an easy target there in Rome. He had a group of people whom they called atheist, promiscuous cannibals. Atheists, because they didn't believe in the pagan gods. Promiscuous, because when they would get together to worship on Sunday, they would have a love meal, an agape dinner. And they interpreted that as an orgy. And then cannibals, because when they got together supposedly to worship God, they were gnawing on somebody's flesh and drinking somebody's blood. So again, if New York had been totally decimated by fire, everybody thought that Mayor de Blasio had done it. But he was trying to blame a whole bunch of immoral, atheist, promiscuous cannibals. How many New Yorkers who had lost family members and homes and skyscrapers would be sending in big checks to their civil defense fund? Nero had found a scapegoat, and a few months after the fire, he dragged the Christians of Rome to the circus of Caligula Nero, where he vested himself in the habit of a charioteer and gave a bloodletting games to try to distract the Romans from what he had done. We have an eyewitness account of what the Christians suffered that day. 7-year-old boy who 34 years later became the great Tacitus, the pagan Roman historian, who wrote in his annals that Nero punished with the utmost refinements of cruelty this class of men and women whom the crowd called Christians. He said that there were three ways the Christians died that day. First, they were covered with wild animal skins and ripped to death by dogs. Second is that they were crucified. St. Peter was upside down. And then third, some of these crucifixion victims, as dust began to descend, were covered with liquid and lit on fire to serve as living torches for the games at night. Said that Nero was riding around the circus in the habit of a charioteer, celebrating what was happening to the Christians. And Tacitus tells us that there started to arose a sentiment of pity because the Romans there in the circus recognized that these Christians were being killed not to placate the gods, not in justice because they had set the fire of Rome, but all to one man's ferocity. Ordinary Christians who paid the supreme sacrifice for the one who had come into this world to pay the supreme sacrifice for them. There's always a great temptation for us as Christians not to do the either or when it comes, or to do the either or rather than the both and when it comes to martyrdom. We can approach it from a purely human perspective and say, what an incredible tragedy. And from an exclusively human perspective, it is. Or some of the times we can be hyper supernatural and just say, can I congratulate you, ma'am, on the brutal execution of your baby boy? For us, as Christians, we're supposed to do the both and. On a human level, it is a great tragedy that people would murder innocent people as scapegoats. But on a supernatural level, we know that this is the great triumph of their life of faith, and that their death was only a beginning, a passage into eternity with the one who would triumph over death precisely to make their triumph possible. It's the same thing for us. As we enter into these stormy seas, as we face what very likely could be various upgraded stages of persecution. From a worldly perspective, what a tragedy. From the perspective of Americans who love our Constitution, a terrible travesty. From the perspective of God, this is going to be the time for our faith to shine. We know the Lord's with us in the boat. We know He's not really asleep. We know that He's doing this precisely in order to give a chance for us to proclaim our faith under duress, which will be so much more effective than proclaiming it under specific circumstances. The Lord wills to save us. He has sent His angels to tell us what we need to do and how we need to head toward Him and away from what is corrupt. He wants to transform us today precisely to be those angels guiding others to Christ, to the salvation He incessantly brings. And the greatest way we do that is each day, in which we die to ourselves and He rises from the dead within. It's not the Lord who's asleep, but many times we are asleep to the real heart of the gospel, that paschal mystery we enter into fully.